Hello, this is Dr. Shiva. Welcome to our podcast, Get Educated or Be Enslaved.
Episode 1471, air date August 18th, 2024.
All right, everyone. Good evening. This is Dr. Shiva Idure. I'm very excited because Dr. Cynthia McKinney and I have been wanting to get together. So we're going to have a conversation on a number of things. One of the topics is going to be the whole notion of second-class citizenship in the United States and why the law allows me to be citizen, the journey that we're going through, which is in some ways, Cynthia, we were just sharing, a replay of what occurred during colonialism. And the fact that Kamala Harris is the one who is working hard with the Democratic Party to take me off the ballot, violating the 14th Amendment, violating the Civil Rights Act in New Jersey, is pretty telling. They always use dark people to manipulate other dark people. And for that matter, now we have neo-colonialism where they have brown people and dark people and white people. Trump wants to be dark, but he doesn't get it quite right. He goes orange. Kamala Harris wants to be white, you know. By the way, the number one consumer product in India, do you know what it is?
It's probably a bleaching cream for your skin.
Because I am
not very far away from India, and that certainly is the case here.
Yeah. So that's what's interesting. So to everyone joining, this is Dr. Shiva Idure and Cynthia McKinney, and we're just going to have Cynthia, you, it's very early morning. Cynthia's got to teach class out where you are. Can I mention where you are or no?
I'm in Bangladesh. People know I'm in Bangladesh.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. So Cynthia, maybe you should just start with, you know, your journey, how you came to find out about our campaign, and I'll talk about my journey, and then we'll riff on this whole thing of what's going on right now with our campaign, and then talk about the deep political aspects from both of our studies and our journeys. Go ahead, Cynthia.
Okay. Well, I first came to know about you when you ran for U.S. Senate, and I thought that you made some path-breaking discoveries about censorship in the United States, censorship that's not supposed to take place, and preferential use of government power against individual citizens. Because of course, you know, I have kind of experienced the same thing from the standpoint of political parties not allowing or not wanting my point of view to be represented within their ranks. The use of state power against my candidacy for re-election, against my incumbency as I served in the United States Congress. And so you kind of walk the same path that I walk. And I admire people who fight back. And you fought back. You actually fought back. And you fought back not only convincingly to the public, but you fought back legally. I wasn't able to do that because I didn't have enough money to fight back when they stole my election using the electronic voting machines and other mechanisms get after me, to get me out of the Congress. But you fought back, and you fought back successfully. And now we know what we know because of you, even if you don't get the credit. The bottom line is that we know about Facebook and Twitter and all of that being used against candidates and used against citizens exercising their legitimate rights. We know about it because of you.
Yeah, Cynthia, what's interesting is, oh, by the way, Rex is joining us. I think he's here. Are you there? William, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, so just, by the way, want to thank William. William's the one who connected Dr. McKinney and I. To Cynthia's point, this, by the way, Cynthia, I'm not sure if you're aware, but when I did this lawsuit, we couldn't find any lawyer to do it. I had to represent myself. So the entire lawsuit here, where we expose the fact that state power, the government power, had this entire backdoor infrastructure involving Democrats and Republicans. And this infrastructure, known as the portal, was used to silence me through the entire thing. This was long before Twitter files. They sat on the story. Elon, I call him Fucker Carlson, excuse my language, but that's what he is. And Glenn Greenwald sat on this story. All of it's documented. We sent it to them in October of 2020, and they didn't do anything because they, in my view, they're deep state agents. They sit on stories, they wait on it, They do a limited hangout 2 years later, and then they try to not only take credit. And I think, you know, even those people will say credit doesn't matter. I'll tell you why credit matters. Not for whenever the people actually doing the fighting bottoms up try to get credit, they say, oh, you're being self-promotional. The reason credit matters, a friend of mine, Arvind Gupta in India, said, was because it tells people the journey, and the journey matters. What was a journey that brought people to discover the backdoor portal to Twitter, or the invention of email, your journey to fight against the Zionists in Congress, right? And expose AIPAC. You were one of the first people to do that. The journey matters because it would not have been, your journey is the one that gave you that perspective to discover these things, you say? So credit does matter. Right. The oppressor always says, oh, credit doesn't matter. And they brainwash us. They always take the people actually do the work and try to make us be humble. You know, growing up as an Indian in a low caste, as an untouchable in India, you're always told, be meek, you know? The Christians are told, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. All this nonsense about be meek, be humble. Meanwhile, they're not humble. They steal your stuff, they take it, and then we are actually truly, sincerely humble. But you come to a point in life where you realize it's not worth being humble. It's okay to be humble if everyone around you is playing the same rules. They don't play the same rules. No. They steal your stuff. And the reason they credit matters is because they want to show that it originates with them, not from organically from people from below. That's why So that's why it matters. When I discovered the backdoor portal to Twitter, I mean, it was day and night work. I had to write all those lawsuits, foregoing all my other academic work, my engineering work, my business, and no lawyer wanted to do it. In fact, when the court appointed a lawyer, he was a Zionist hoodlum who was representing Dershowitz. He didn't tell me at the time, against the Epstein case, okay? He said, Shiva, just drop all the claims against the government. You'll be the first guy on Twitter. He was trying to, you know, they wanted to toast their martinis on Martha's Vineyard by saying we put this rabble-rouser back on the internet so they could act like they were protecting the First Amendment. But the reality was they wanted me to drop all the claims against the government. They wanted to gut the lawsuit. I said, F off. In 3 days before, he had 7 weeks to brief up my lawsuit for appellate review. And he was brought in by the judge to tank the case, even though I was doing well against seven lawyers. So anyway, the reality is we didn't have any money. We did it. I've learned the law. I've learned how to fight in federal court. I probably have more litigation experience than probably 99% of lawyers. Most lawyers settle the cases with the adversary on the courthouse steps. They don't want to fight it because they don't want to bring up all the dirty laundry. So, but Cynthia, I think it'd be valuable if you tell people your journey. I mean, you know, to our audience from being a House of Representatives, what you faced with the Zionist cabal in Congress. I just think just a little bit of that would be valuable.
Well, my journey with the cabal began when I received a fax from AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And basically AIPAC said that you should sign this pledge. And when I read it, it was a pledge not to the U.S. Constitution like my oath was going to be. Now, the pledge was to the state of Israel. And it was kind of an open-ended pledge to Israel. And I refused to sign it. Well, that's when I began to really learn what Washington, D.C. is all about. So if you rely on, I had raised no money. I had no money. And so I was, 1992 is the year I'm talking about. It was dubbed the year of the woman. Well, last time I checked, I'm a woman. So I thought that it would be, you know, all that the judgment on me would be on my past performance as a legislator in the Georgia House of Representatives, the advocacy in my sort of, you know, the things that I stand for, my values and my morals and that sort of thing. And I thought that would be sort of, you know, what people would judge me by. But no, whether it was the environmental organizations or women's organizations. The bottom line was, if I was going to get their endorsement, I had to sign the pledge. That's what I learned. So I would get these phone calls, and the phone calls would come in, and they'd say, oh, we'd like to do a fundraiser for you. And they'd take me maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks down the road of plotting the fundraiser. And then the next thing I know, I'm getting a question. Well, did you sign the pledge? And I have to say, no, I didn't sign the pledge. And then, you know, it was an automatic click up. They'd hang up the phone. And then I realized the interconnectedness of all of these so-called political action committees, the PACs, and they're supposed to be liberal. They're supposed to be pro-woman, pro-environment, pro-whatever. It took me forever to get even like the Sierra Club endorsement. And I was a member of Sierra Club. I was the only candidate that was actually a member of the Sierra Club for long standing. So it was that kind of, you know, sort of bumping into the abrupt reality of how the pro-Israel lobby is not just AIPAC. So when people say that it's AIPAC, it's not just AIPAC. And so I articulated this. I gave voice to it, and I was the first person to ever expose it. And so then they changed their tactic, and some podcaster contacted me and said, how can we understand how this works? So I real time took a podcaster through two random candidates, one Democratic candidate, one Republican candidate, went to their websites, and then we just read the section on their website that was for Israel. And they basically said the same thing. And I said, see, this is what the pro-Israel lobby forces you to put this kind of language somewhere on your website. So now this is before the candidate is actually elected. So it doesn't really matter who wins, right? Because the pro-Israel lobby is going to win because they've gotten the signature or the statement from every candidate that's on the ballot. And these nominees, the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee, have already signed their lives, hitched their wagon to the pro-Israel lobby, or the pro-Israel lobby has hitched their wagon to them. So while I was in the Congress, not having signed, I lasted for 12 years. It was darn near impossible, but I did. And it was, I call it trench warfare, because every day that I was on Capitol Hill, it was a fight just to be there. And like you say, you want to get some recognition for some of the things that you do. Well, it's not going to happen in that environment. You know, it's just so after two unceremonious, kickings to my rear end to get me out of the Congress, then I began a different journey, and that's the journey that I'm on now. I became, what can I say, sort of awake to the intergenerationality, the criminality of the and the internationality of the pro-Israel lobby. You know, it's not just in the United States that they act. I went to Western Europe. I was in Paris at the time of the announcement that Barack Obama had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, I was there because I was doing a 911 truth event in Paris. And then what they said was that if you question the narrative of 911, guess what? You're anti-Semitic. So now how does anti-Semitism come to play with 911 truth? I didn't get that. That was in Paris. So now we understand that there are certain things we can say and there are certain things we can not say. There's certain things we can research, which I was researching 911 because it happened when I was there. And I want to know how the people of the United States pay trillions of dollars in a military and an intelligence infrastructure, and it fails four times in one day. How does that happen? I think that's a legitimate question. We still don't have the answer to that question.
Yeah, and no one really knows how a bunch of hand gliders come over on October 7th, right? By the way, the picture of hand gliders appeared nearly 10 years before that on a front page article on The Economist. You probably have seen that, you know? It was a foreshadowing of what they were going to do. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen
it. Yeah, it's a very interesting, I think I can bring it up. But the December, I believe, front cover, December 2012, front cover of The Economist has a picture of people on hand gliders. Here it is. I just found it here. Okay. And it's quite illustrative. Let me see here. I think I can bring it up here. I just found it here. But if you look here, so this cover appeared nearly, here it is. Can you see this cover here?
So let me see if I can bring it up.
I think I have to bring it up. But if you see this cover here, it's got Netanyahu with a hand glider. Let me see if I can go to another version of it. Let me go back here. I think I'll find a high-res version of it. Okay, here we go. Size. All right. Large. All right. So here we go. All right. All right. So this is a very interesting front page cover on The Economist done in December 22nd, 2012. It says a rough guide to hell. You see, it's someone with Hamas on a hand glider, Netanyahu on a hand glider over Israel. Can you see that?
I can't see it. let me see.
Right there.
Make it a little bigger.
Even bigger. There.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Okay. And this is but December 22nd holiday issue. Okay, December 22nd.
Wow.
It's you know, people on hand gliders over Israel. But anyway, is it a foreshadowing? Where does this come from? But what I wanted to, as a follow-up, Cynthia, I know we were talking before. I think the journey that you went through with what you call the Zionist infrastructure, which is more than just AIPAC, it's sort of a tentacle stuff that influences all these quote unquote pro-inclusion groups, pro-environment groups are everywhere. It's an infrastructure that the applications emerge on the front facing of these organizations.
Let me just add that it's also Hollywood.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So it's our entertainment, it's professional athletics. It is every aspect of life they have put their tentacles in. And I think it comes from the fact that they are in charge of the U.S. currency in the Federal Reserve. So they can buy everybody, they can buy everything, and of course they do.
Yeah, there's a deep interconnection between foreign policy and economic, local economic policy. And that occurs through the who prints the money and how the money is distributed through the yes. Fed. So you need war. Machinery of war is Israel. So war is necessary as a basis to print money. So you have war, you print money, and he who prints money becomes a reserve currency, right? The reserve currency, in order to be the reserve currency, you need to have military might. The U.S. currency is not backed by oil or even gold. It's backed by aircraft carriers, and that's what Israel is to the elite.
That's right.
One big aircraft carrier. So they must conduct war, and from war, they get to print money, and they get to control the economies of every other part of the world because they cause inflation, they devalue everyone else. But my journey was interesting to this because growing up And I think it's to those people seeing, you know, William, and then you see these two dark faces, Cynthia and I, and typically what's happened is that the Black African-American community and the Indian community do not interact in the United States. Many Indians are racist in the United States because of their Brahmin background. And many Blacks do not trust Indians. And it's fascinating because if you look at African history and you look at the history of the untouchables in India, they're intertwined. The first indentured servants were people of my background, which were the same, you know, they were the first ones that were brought to Trinidad and the West Indies. And then you had that next wave of African Americans. But the elites have been very, very successful in separating the working people of both of these communities, poor whites, poor Blacks, poor lower caste in untouchable. So I have a perspective on that because I grew up in India, Cynthia, where as a child, I don't know if I've shared this with you, but I remember as a kid, 4 years old, playing soccer and going to this woman's home with my friend, and his mother spit at me and said, stay outside, you're a Shudra, which is like the N-word, and gave me water in a different cup, right? It's no different than segregation. And I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was very deeply hurt. I asked my mother and she said, when she was a child going to the well to get water, the Brahmins would spit at her and say, you're a pig, shoot, you know, go away. This was the nature of Indian casteism. And this was perpetuated and never dealt with, not by Gandhi. Gandhi was a casteist. And people to understand Gandhi didn't do jack shit in Africa. He was trying to help wealthy Hindus in the Transvaal region get trading rights. And he failed miserably at that. And then the elite Indians sort of parachuted him in because in the 1920s, there was a massive revolutionary movement in India. There was a sepoy mutiny where the Indian soldiers, a sepoy meant an Indian who was in the British army, right? The British would get the Indians to fight in the army. The French would get the Indians to fight in the army. The Dutch would get the Indians to fight in their army. So when you heard 5,000 soldiers of the British fought 5,000 soldiers of the French, 90% of them were Indians fighting Indians. It's quite amazing how they got this to happen. But anyway, Gandhi was parachuted in because there was a bottoms-up movement occurring of all different radical trends who wanted a revolution, a good bloody revolution in India, like they had the American Revolution. They wanted to wipe out the elites of India. So Gandhi was brought in and, you know, suddenly he takes off his jacket and whatever, his lawyer shirt, and puts on spectacles, starts spinning a wheel in the house of Gokhale, who was a bootlicker to the British. He was housed in a beautiful mansion. I mean, this doesn't happen. You are promoted, just like Martin Luther King was promoted by the Kennedys in the Southern National Christian Conference over Malcolm X. And white liberals, if you're hearing this, you need to get this straight, okay? Because when you promote Gandhi, you're promoting a guy who promoted the caste system, who's for the oppression of women. And so,
well, for that matter, when they promote Tulsi Gabbard and Kamala Harris, it's the same thing.
Same thing. Tulsi Gabbard is a warmonger. She was all out for bombing Iraq after 9/11. She was all out for devastating Palestine. And yet she talks about Hinduism. Now, so what happened to me, Cynthia, is when I saw that as a young child, believe it or not, I started studying revolutionary literature as a five-year-old kid. I want to understand. I hated this caste system. It really hurt me at a very deep level. I took it very personally. My grandparents were poor village farmers who had, you know, like sharecroppers. They had a small piece of land, no shoes. So a third of my life I spent with them. My grandparents practiced indigenous systems of medicine. They practiced what was called Shaivite Hinduism, which is much more a natural religion, you see, not the caste-based. Mm-hmm. So there is this spiritual form of Hinduism. And so I got very interested in this, and I never could resolve that until many years later, until 1984. So I witnessed this deep abusive caste system in India personally. And then the fact that my mom and dad came here, they were extraordinary people. They're one in a trillion. My mom got a master's degree in India at a time when women weren't getting anything. Her father ran away with another woman. So she was made homeless with eight of her kids. So my mom went through this journey where she decided she was going to stand up. And when she would go to school, people would spit on her. Oh, you don't have a father. So she went through her journey. There's a picture of my mom graduating, this dark-skinned Indian woman with all light white men with turbans. You see, so my mom was a revolutionary. My dad grew up in war-torn Burma. He didn't see his first book until he was 11 years old, studied under a mango tree with a guy who taught him math. So my parents were extraordinary human beings in retrospect. Fighters, very smart. I mean, just raw brain power. And they had defiance. So they left India. So we came to Paterson, New Jersey in 1970, Cynthia. Think about this Indian family coming like on a spaceship. And what's going on in 1970? You may remember Vietnam War, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? When we came here, we were in a one-bedroom home where you have to put coal into those, whatever those things to even get heat, you know? So I witnessed segregation right here. We were black community, right? It was no different than being in Bombay, right? And my parents, whatever money they would earn, they believed in education. They felt education was a way out. Then we moved to a working class community called Clifton, New Jersey, which was half black, half white. And then we moved to Parsippany, which was still working class, all predominantly white. And then the last 3 years, all public schools, my mom hated elite private school. She thought it was garbage. We moved into Livingston, New Jersey, the home of Chris Christie, the home of Ivanka, the Trumps, the home of Kushners. And I felt so out of place because all these kids had clothes, really nice clothes. I mean, we had clothes, but I felt, wow, we don't fit in here. So my only way out was, Cynthia, was excelling in academics. And and in those days, they had 900 kids in a class. And I was number one in that class. And this was a high school where you had people like Harlan Coben go, Jason Alexander, Chris Christie, right? And so I remember in eighth or ninth grade in Parsippany, as we were transitioning to Livingston, I had won the math award. And typically, you know, you have to pass all these exams. And so the teacher gets up in an auditorium and he says, typically we give the math award to two kids. And he said, but this year, no one came close to Shiva. Standing ovation. I leave that hall and my mom was the one who encouraged me to excel. She was in a massive accident in the ICU. So I wasn't even thinking about winning this. Oh, I was rushing to my mom's ICU. This Jewish woman comes running at me and my father. And she says, your son has done nothing great. My son, Eric Greenberg, that was his name, had he worked hard, he could have won that award. Screaming at me with such vile hatred. Okay. And now in Livingston, me and my sister were the only two dark-skinned kids. And you saw this same thing perpetuated, this concept of the chosen people. I had these very good young kids in ninth grade. The parents would send them to Israel in the summertime, and they'd come back wanting to kill every freaking Arab and Palestinian. I mean, just raving lunatics, total indoctrination. So I saw this chosen people concept play out. And because I was good, Cynthia, because I worked my freaking butt off, they didn't know what to do. It was difficult for them. I created the first email system when I was a 14-year-old kid. But it wasn't done at Livingston. It was done in Newark, New Jersey, all African-American community. The people who inspired me were the African-American workers who were the secretaries predominantly. Email was created to transform the interoffice mail system for them. And the thought of a woman using a computer in 1978 was unheard of. It was old white guys in lab coats. You may remember this, writing complex code. So email was a liberating tool for those people. So when I came to MIT, I already had some of these concepts. I was done with technology. I didn't even want to go to MIT. I wanted to just do carpentry, believe it or not. I got, so here I'm at a all predominantly Jewish school, number one kid in math and science. Don't you think someone would have told me about MIT? Like, hey, you
what,
should
apply. No one told you?
No one told me about MIT. I mean, no one told me. So what happened?
You know, this is not unusual because I went to Catholic high school and basically which was, you know, all run by non-black people. And so the black students at that high school were divided into the ones that could go to college and the ones that couldn't go to college. And if you happen to fall into that category in their minds of the ones who couldn't make it in college, then you didn't get counseling. And I have many of my classmates that ended up at Georgia Tech. They went to Georgia Tech despite what was told to them, because they were outright told, you're not college material. And but this is the kind of apartheid that continues to exist in the United States. Well, at least it existed during my time. And I'm absolutely certain that it continues to this day.
When did you go to undergraduate, Cynthia? What year?
73.
Okay. So for me, I went in 81, right? So the way I got to MIT was very interesting. My mother was always helping random people. She'd help these two women who'd been kicked out of their homes by their husbands. She met him at the A&P store, you know, A&P?
I remember
those A&Ps, and she said, you can stay at our home, right? She was just very helpful, always like a good Samaritan. One of the women had a wacky friend, and he came over, and he was like this wacky mathematician, and he said, you should apply to this place called MIT. And he held up the brochure. This was only 2 weeks was left. I was applying to Stevens Institute of Technology, which was a local school, and Princeton, because it was all in New Jersey. But Princeton looked too, something about it was too not city, and it didn't have any vibrancy. So this guy said, you should apply to MIT. And I saw Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I thought it was like some wacky mental institute. I had no interest. I was into athletics and sports and all this stuff. So then he came back and he said, if you're not going to apply, I'm not going to leave. So I filled out the application with a pencil. I get accepted. Then my Jewish physics teacher, who literally had the Holocaust numbers, or at least, you know, what she said, oh, you should go, Shiva. You, why did she say that after I was accepted? Because the school gets credit. She gets credit as you see, they get points. So I came to MIT and I didn't want to go there. I thought the people looked nuts. They didn't look, I don't know, something was off with these, most of the people I saw. The only reason I came was she said, you will like a city. And I always grew up in, I had this thing of, you know, a little more vibrancy. So I came, and the first person I started, I was very interested in systems. I had enough credits to graduate MIT in 2 years. I was very bored, even what you would think with MIT, because of all the email stuff I'd done. So my journey was I organized a radical newspaper on campus. And when a black dean was fired, who was supporting affirmative action, you know, some of the reformist policies, which were nonetheless good at that, you know, for what they did. So my friends at MIT were poor blacks from the inner cities, the few that they let in, poor white kids, poor Hispanics. The Indian students at MIT were racist and casteist. They would try to find my last name, and they would figure out that I was a low caste Indian. Okay. So a lot of Americans don't understand this. The Indians that came to MIT were graduate students who came right out of India on the boat. And their last names were Ayers or this. I mean, these are names right when you see it. They're the upper caste Indians. So this is quite important for people to understand. So when that's what I'm saying. When black African Americans, oh, he's an Indian guy, because they have been actually abused by some Indian. But they need to understand that when I came to MIT, all my friends were poor blacks who would come in freshman year, and they didn't have the infrastructure in the inner cities, and they would fail. And MIT did that by design. They let black people in and they wanted them to fail. Now, Shirley Jackson was a MIT PhD student in 1968. She was delivering her PhD dissertation, only two black students at MIT in 1963, I think 68. And she threw down her thesis and she lectured all these old white men. She goes, how come there's only two black people here? The next year, they let in, I think, 15 black students who took over the MIT faculty club, and they protested and they demanded, hey, the inner cities have no infrastructure. Anyway, so that was a milieu that I grew up around. So when this black dean got fired, we started a newspaper and we started mobilizing students. I burned the South African flag on the steps of MIT. We organized one of the biggest protests, you see. So, and it was in 1984, Cynthia, I learned that Jesse Jackson was an Uncle Tom sellout, right? He gave all of his votes to
Rainbow.
So that's when I broke with all of this lesser of evils nonsense. So to me, the journey was and we held one of the biggest protests in 1985 against Mayor Kahana. Remember that idiot who was a brutal racist when Ariel Sharon had run over tanks?
Yes.
So we organized one of the biggest protests and we took up the slogan, Zionism is racism in the service of imperialism. So my politics as an 18-year-old, Cynthia, were very well honed in understanding the dynamics. And it just continued from that point on. But I never believed in electoral politics. right? It was only in 2016 when I saw more anti-establishment. I said, why don't I jump and run against Elizabeth Warren, who we exposed as a racist, fake Indian. And then we ran in 2020 when you came to come across us, right? But the election right now, our running for president is quite historic. What's even more historic is getting back to your what you just shared with Congress. We have bottoms up volunteers all over the world right now, 500,000 people in the Movement for Truth, Freedom, Health. To mobilize that movement and to give people, empower people, we said, let's get on the ballot in every state, which meant we had to build our own infrastructure. Leaders came out, all bottoms up, Cynthia. So in New Jersey, a school teacher, Rose Cius, organized 800 other people, 18 electors. Sorry, I think 14 electors we got on the ballot in New Jersey. Legitimately, we didn't pay people like Kennedy did, right? We didn't have AIPAC money. Nice day, and they collected signatures. We got all the signatures. The electors were put on the ballot. And guess who comes after us? Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party, saying that I'm not qualified to be on the ballot because I'm a natural born citizen. A, look at the irony of it. First, you don't have any jurisdiction over me. There have been multiple people been put on the ballot since 1972. One who was a Nicaraguan citizen, Roger Calero, twice, 2004 and 8. Because remember, you're not voting for the president. You're voting for the electors. And he was allowed to get votes. Linda Jenness, who was 31 years old. Larry Holmes, who was 33. So why are, and but they were, quote unquote, small party candidates. I have a massive presence. So the Democratic Party pulls the race card. And who does this? The Democratic Party. The Secretary of State.
Yes, because it's very strategic in their minds that they chose Kamala to do it when anyone else could have done it. But no, they chose Kamala to do it.
Exactly.
So that it's Indian versus Indian. They did this with me all of the time. They, you know, because
they get blacks probably, right?
They wanted to get me out of Congress. So they, you know, they figured out, well, running a white person against her isn't gonna work, which they did for a while. And then they started running black people against me. So, you know, but it's not surprising. And it is a racist move.
Yeah. And that's what I want our audience to understand, this depth of racism, the real way this works. So the reason I shared Gandhi and as we were talking, Cynthia, is that the British imperialism, Zionism, Nazism, figured out that you never use the white people to oppress a brown man. You find brown people. They did this all over Africa. And so that's why Gandhi was used, parachuted in. So white men with crowns transferred power to brown men with white hats. That's what actually took place in India.
Yeah, that's the way plantations were run in the South. So you had the plantation owner and he just made sure everything ran. You had the white person who was the cracker, that's where that term comes from, because he would whip those slaves that were out of order or that were runaways or whatever. But then you had the black overseer who made sure that the slaves all stayed in line and did their work and that sort of thing. So if you look at the politics of the United States today, who's the cracker? Who's the overseer and who's the plantation owner? Those are things that we can analogize even right now.
Yeah, Cynthia, what we have is we started putting together a series of videos we give away for free. It's called Get Off the Plantation. The plantation mindset is what we're really about because we have a lot of house slaves, as Malcolm X said, who are on the plantation. But if you take that whole, and this is to the 1.8 billion Indians out there, who are still on the plantation. 99% of Indians are still on the plantation. India never had a good revolution. India was stunted. Its growth was stunted by Gandhi and the British elites. If you look at India in 1947, there was no real independence. The documents are called transfer of power. I don't know if you've read, it's called transfer of power. It's not called the Declaration of Indian Independence, it's called the transfer of power.
Yeah.
So Nehru, which was a Brahmin, Kashmiri Brahmin, the Brahmin of the Brahmin of the Brahmin, who was, by the way, banging Mountbatten's wife. Mountbatten, more by all accords, was gay.
Oh my gosh.
Edwina Mountbatten was the lover of the Prime Minister of India. Gandhi anointed him. The torch gets passed from a white man with crown to a brown man, sort of brown guy, you know, with a white hat. And what the British did, they remote controlled India. They invested $5 billion more in India after they left. So they created this whole Indian administrative service, which was used to oppress the Indian people. So India never got. So now if you take that and you project it to now, and what I witnessed, Cynthia, was this. In 2020, when I was the one who exposed the real issue with the pandemic, wrote to Trump, I gave people solutions. And I will vociferously take credit for it for the reasons I said. It's important. And it's taken me a while to have this voice, Cynthia, to take credit. And I think if you have done something, take the fucking credit. Don't be humble. It's not worth being humble against these oppressors. You must voice, and people say you're being self-promotional. You must tell them to go fuck themselves, okay? Because they have an entire machinery in Hollywood. Every, you know, who gets the title? Right. They're not humble people. Right. They have a whole legal infrastructure to decide. We don't have that legal infrastructure. So not only do I have to do the work, not only do you have to do the work, but we have to fight for our credit. We don't have the bifurcated people fighting for us. So anyway, what you saw happen was that you had this reality that when someone like me runs for office, right? We have to do all the work of exposing this stuff like we did with the backdoor portal to Twitter, like we did. And we also have to promote ourselves because no one else is going to promote us. Right.
That's right.
Elon Musk has a whole promotional thing. He's a dope. He's not a genius. He's never made anything. He takes over companies and he's an actor of the deep state promoted by them. So,
yes, that's right.
So anyway, so that's what I witnessed, Cynthia. I saw this reality of the oppression that takes place and the realization that in 2020, I was this brown face and there was a vacuum. This bothered the elite. So overnight, who do you see in 2023? Vivek the Snake, a fucking Brahmin, a Zionist Brahmin, Tulsi Gabbard, another Zionist Brahmin. Suddenly they find this other suddenly doctors start showing up who were silent in March of 2020 against the pandemic. And they pushed them forward, right?
Yes.
This was deliberate. They found a lot of brown faces in high places to keep the field slave, which was me, who had gotten off the plantation, because they don't want people to hear this voice to give. That's they don't want people to hear your voice. They don't want a black woman who's exposing Martin Luther King or Gandhi. They want to keep our voices suppressed because we speak for the broad mass of all people, black, white, the multiracial group of people who are treated as second-class citizens. So this is very deliberate. So Kamala Harris was used to take me off the ballot in New Jersey. And I want to share with you. So I've had to by myself, by the way, no lawyer wants to take on the government. I must've talked to 50 lawyers in New Jersey. Oh, no, we don't want to take on the government. So think about that. So not only do I have to do my work, not only have to run for office, but I have to write my own legal briefs. The amount of-
And the lawyers don't want to take on the cabal either. The Zionist cabal, they don't want to take over them is either.
Yeah,
which today is the government too.
Right. So this was, I demanded the Supreme Court put me back on the ballot, right? And this reporter, right, Joey Fox, he did, you know, point this out, what I wrote in my, they only give you like a little box of like 200 words. I said, Idre has even gone higher up, insisting the Supreme Court that the ruling removing him from the ballot was incorrect and prejudicial, debasing my qualifications on being president, which at this time is putting the cart before the horse, violates the New Jersey Civil Rights Act, the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Idre wrote in his request for emergent relief, I did not give allegiance to America, foregoing my Indian citizenship to be treated as a second-class citizen, independent of the violent, invidious discrimination of those parties' defective rulings. A stay must be issued to ensure the New Jersey slate of electors. Look, I'm not running on November 5th. This is the 12th Amendment. The electors are also being... So let me share with you this other thing. So I put that out there, obviously the Supreme Court, New Jersey Supreme Court, which is all made up of Zionists, denied even giving me the right to even speak. This is no different than what happened in ninth grade. In ninth grade, a teacher said, even though I'm the number one student, wouldn't let me participate in the exam to prove I was a number one student. They kept me out of the battleground. So this same reporter then writes this. New Jersey Supreme Court bats down Iadure's ballot access appeal. Okay. Now look what he says. And then he justifies this in the following way. He says, Iadure, a former New Jersey resident who graduated Livingston High School, has made several unsuccessful runs. He's promoted a variety of conspiracy theories during his campaign related to COVID and vaccine, and has also taken a stridently anti-Israel position, referring to Prime Minister Netanyahu as Satan. Okay? So that is embedded into this. So it's the bottom line is he's showing his cards. The reality is he's saying, yes, because he is anti-Zionist, this is justified, right?
But now, I don't, if you could go back to that article,
yep.
Because they say who isn't a natural born citizen, but as far as I know, and you know, I haven't kept up on the law on this, although I do have an interest because of, I want my son to be able to be a president one day. And if he can't be a president because, well, he's a U.S. citizen, so why can't he be a president even though he was born in Jamaica? But he's a U.S. citizen at birth. So, I mean, what was the problem? So as far as I know, this whole definition of natural born citizen hasn't been litigated and has never been defined. So if that's the case, then they can't say it's misleading for them to say up at the top there. It's misleading for them to say who isn't a natural born citizen.
Exactly. They can't say that. Yeah. And furthermore, I think everyone needs to understand. So I've studied this very deeply. And there's probably only 100 people understand this now on the planet, because 99% of lawyers are dumb. 99% of judges got to be judges by sucking Zionist cock. Okay. Excuse my language, but that's how they got there. Most judges are dumb. Except a few.
I've been listening to you, Dr. Shiva.
Yeah.
I've excused your language.
Sorry about that. It comes naturally. It's not something I intend to do, but I did, you know, I believe that you should use this language against these people because you have to reset their neural networks. That's what it's deserved. It's the right thing to do. But anyway, and by the way, after I did that video on that, South Park did a whole thing. Right. But no credit. It's OK on the Zionist cocksuckery. OK. But here's what's happened. And it's fascinating. If you the work of John Yinger, who's a professor at SUNY. So if you go back at the time of the Constitution, when it was being put together. In my view, the framers were really looking to support people who are going to be loyal to the Constitution. They allowed naturalized citizens. Why do I say that? The ambiguity is there because they did a carve out for anyone who was in the existing colonies. Many of them tens of thousands of people were born in England or France who became citizens. Right. They said they too could run for president, which means they were naturalized citizens. And then they said natural born. And then in early 1800, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was a French born citizen, was made a natural born citizen. So when you put all this together, it's naturalized citizen and natural born. So the theory was a natural born citizen would be more loyal. Well, that's not true, as you've seen in Congress. All these natural born citizens are loyal to Israel.
Yes, and, that's right.
But they were naturalized citizens at the time of the Constitution who could become president. Seven of them signed the Constitution. William Paterson, New Jersey did. So you have the ambiguity right there. In fact, Madison Hamilton, we don't know what the debates took place on that, you know, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5, right? Which is, a natural born was never defined. Never defined. But the point is, to all of you listening out there, naturalized citizens could become president even then. I believe there's a guy called John Lucerne who was a Senate pro temp, and he was born in England. Okay. So people say, oh, they didn't want foreigners to come in. They had foreigners, guys, who could become president. Now you go to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment unequivocally says directly, it says that all citizens, natural born and naturalized, are equal and are protected by the Equal Protection Clause. Period. It ends right there. It's over. Why are we even discussing this? Then you had a very then in 1960,
that's pretty definitive language.
It's definitive. It's over. So why are they doing this, right? And by the way, Schneider versus Rusk, a German woman who's a naturalized citizen, left the United States for 10 years, went to Germany. She tries to come back. They said, no. You left the U.S. for 10 years. You can no longer come back. She said, wait a minute. I'm a citizen. You don't do that to natural born. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that naturalized and natural born, pointing to the 14th Amendment. This is over. But why are they doing this? And this is the analysis that I've come with, Cynthia, and I've spent a lot of time on this. The elites want to always find, they always need to make second-class citizens. Why? For power, profit, control. They need human labor as assets. So the first people that were made second-class citizens by the white settlers were the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Then the next group were the blacks. Mm-hmm. And then the next group were the immigrants who came in, nativism, the Irish and the Italians. Mm-hmm. And then women. Women didn't have the right to vote. Afghan women had the right to vote. Prior to 1917, American women did not. So they made half of the world. So they're always trying to figure out who do we split and make second class citizens. Now you have 30 million naturalized citizens in the United States. They come hardworking like my parents. My dad came here. He was an amazing engineer. He would get paid one third less wage than his white counterpart. You talk to IT engineers who come here, run the infrastructure of the United States. They're always scared they're going to be shipped back. So they always keep one group in fear.
That's right.
Oh, you should be so happy you got to be a citizen. Well, the reason you left your fucking country is because of U.S. imperialism and British imperialism.
Exactly.
And this is what
this is a point. Yeah, this is a point that I make in the current immigration debate, which they never, ever, ever talk about. They want to talk about the people who come in, but they don't talk about what the United States does to those countries over there.
Donald Trump is an open fucking racist, but Kamala Harris is an equal racist. She's a not so obvious version anti-immigrant, right?
Yes.
So this is but it'll be easier for them to be racist against immigrants who built this country, whether you're white, black, yellow, brown. It is immigrants who fucking built America, and they still build this country. And it is the working people, the natives right now, but they want to create this clash between the working people of this country and the immigrants. And those people should unite and shatter the swarm. And that's
we have to unite.
Yep.
And in fact, we should look at all of the many ways that we've been divided and siloed into our many identities. And they're steady creating more identities so that they can silo the population. And what's the purpose of that siloing and balkanization of the population? The bottom line is divide and rule. And so they will divide us until we're all a population of one. And then that way they can have ultimate control over us. And that was one of the reasons why I was so concerned about 6 feet distance, right? Because, you know, you got to stay 6 feet apart from everybody and you're locked down. And whatever is happening in Gaza right now, believe me, it will come to the United States. Yes, it will come to the United States. And in many respects, without the bombing, it has already come to the United States, because the same mentality that controls the situation, that Israeli chosen people mentality, is the same mentality that exists here. I don't even call them elites, by the way. I don't know what to call them. I call them the cabal,
I call them the swarm.
The swarm, that's right. And that's what they do. That's the way they behave. And so they swarm over people who speak the truth, like you and like me, that, you know, there's a swarm against us. And all people don't, I don't know if the population sees that, but because of your work and your organizational skills, you are creating a counter swarm, which we need. It will benefit all of us. The more people who are awake to what's happening and the methods that are being used to suppress loyalty to the United States, the more we will be able to save the United States, which is one of the things that I want to do, and which basically governed why and how I spoke out in the first place.
Well, one of the things, Cynthia, that you pointed out is, you know, by the way, when you were talking, someone said, oh, it's over. I just want to speak to these people who sit on the sidelines and don't ever fucking want to get on the ground and do anything. They need to shut the fuck up and talk about it's over. We can't do anything. This is learned helplessness that they teach the house slaves. And that's a house slave mentality. The reality is nothing is predestined. History is being created moment to moment to moment. And it's based on action. Action is character. And what they've done, Cynthia, with this social media, someone was texting me a couple of weeks ago. Oh my God, Dr. Shiva, they're attacking you. They said you can't run. Please jump in on this thing. And I'm freaking, you know, getting signatures. I go, what are you doing talking to these morons? Get on the ground and help build a movement. So people think talking and doing this kind of stuff with Elon Musk, who is a government agent, he's a Mossad agent, just like Trump, just like Tulsi Gabbard, all these people, that he's talking about, that these people are somehow helping you and being on their platforms and fighting it out with those people is a movement. It isn't. Movement is getting on the ground. You know, we get on the ground, we hand out flyers. We tell people to save yourself. Our slogan, Cynthia, save yourself and we'll teach you how to fight. I'm not your savior. You got to want to save yourself. You want to have to get off the plantation. And you want to
get off the plantation.
Exactly. And when you get off the plantation, you realize there's no fucking booby fucking Kennedy's going to help you. There's no Trump. There's no Tulsi Gabbard. There's no Sadhguru. There's no fucking, you know, MLK. There's no Gandhi. Malcolm X. Yes, Malcolm was trying to teach people how to fight. That's what our movement is. We have to teach people how to fight. And if you want to learn how to fight, then you should vote for me. And you should, you know, listen to Cynthia and other people who've been on the ground. We face the enemy. But if you want to just say, oh, there's nothing you can do, you know, talk about, you know, some Messiah coming sometime in the future. Well, you should just get out of the way because you're part of the swarm, because that is a mentality that they've done. But the concept of chosen people, Cynthia, is what Brahmanism is. If you look at Nazism, Brahmanism, and Zionism, they're all the same. We are the elites. We know better. You're the low caste Shudras. We were anointed by God. We're the priestly class and you're nobody. That is absolutely ditto to Zionism. Absolutely ditto to the Aryan concept. And that's why all these three groups love each other. The quote unquote radical Hindus who actually spit on actually Hinduism that my grandparents practiced, which was a deep connection to nature, which is a deep connection to things that each one of us experiences in other realms. Okay. That we each, it's a very personal relationship. That's what my grandmother practiced. That has nothing to do with talking about you were a dog in your last life. And the reason you're in this situation is because you did something to someone else and making shit up. This is no different than what Manifest Destiny was. So Brahmanism equals Zionism equals Nazism. This is why Vivek the fucking Snake was promoted. Literally stealing my shit. This is why Tulsi Gabbard is promoted. Okay. A warmonger. They are
somebody who was stealing Cynthia's shit.
but that's why Kamala Harris, I think the elites said, well, I think the elites are in this conundrum right now because they sort of used Trump. They, you know, squeezed him and they now need a new user interface. And they're looking at this idiot, Kamala Harris. She has all the things that they can PR. Oh, she's Indian, Jamaican, diversity, but she's a fucking idiot. She cannot do anything. She's a complete incompetent fool. But that's what the elites like, because she can be a wonderful puppet, just like Trump. And that's why her taking me off the ballot, I think, gives us a huge opportunity, Cynthia, to have this discourse, to educate Indians in India. Indians in India are, oh my God, we have an Indian there. No, she's not an Indian, you idiot. She's a fucking Brahmin who hates the Americans.
Exactly. So thank you so much for spending this time with me. Yes.
I haven't spoken for the majority of this because, well, I really just wanted to see how you two bounced off each other. I've just been so happy to, you know, stream this with you. And I've just got to wonder if either of you would consider each other as partners on a ticket. I know Cynthia's like pretty busy, but Cynthia's all, I know she's busy, but she was busy when she ran with my fallen hero, Jesse Ventura. And it was still a kick-ass ticket. I'm just wondering if either of you would, you know, consider each
other. Yeah, I mean, where I'm right now is we have a woman, Crystal Ellis, who's a mother. You know, Crystal's been in our movement. I have her. But, Cynthia, we should collaborate on many levels, you know?
One thing
I've thought about, Cynthia, is that we announce our cabinet, okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We actually have our ex officio cabinet. And you and I should talk about that, you know, and you and I should do more of these streams to educate people. It is very important for African Americans listening to this. When you see this face, when you look at Indian, don't think Indian. It's a class war. There are Indians who are Brahmins, who are the 0.0001%, which are most of the ones in the United States who fucking are racist. They're racist towards me and they're racist towards you. Vivek the Snake is a fucking racist, but he will suck Zionist cock all day long. Okay. And the Hinduism that he speaks about is a Hinduism supporting the caste system. And there's a fundamental difference between Judaism. When I was in Clifton and Persepolis, there were Jews that I knew who were working class Jews. In Nazi Europe, there were Jews, trade union leaders who were fighting against Hitler. The bourgeois Jews were the Zionists. So we cannot forget the class contradictions here. We have to talk about class, which elites do not want to talk about. So I've experienced that. So it's very, very important people understand that Cynthia and I being here is itself historic, because the swarm wants to keep black people and Indian people separated, but they will fuse Indians and blacks into an elite like Kamala Harris. The Jamaican blacks, you may know, have an elite black system within the Jamaican blacks. They think they're better than all other African Americans. And that's where Kamala Harris's lineage is. And in India, among the Brahmins, there's a group called Tamil Brahmins. They call them Tamil, which are the highest Brahmins. And that's where Kamala Harris's mother is. People don't understand. She's the elite of the elite of the elite. Meaning she comes from this background where she can be an idiot and she gets to be president. She's a complete bloody idiot. Okay. So, Cynthia, thank you very much. And William, thank you for organizing this. I know you were trying hard. And Cynthia's, I know it's what, 8 a.m. or something like that. But thank you, Cynthia. But let's keep in touch. But, you know, let's fight. You know, we're comrades in arms.
Yes.
Here, idiots, you know?
That's but right. Thank you so much for what you do every day, Dr. Shiva.
Same with you, Cynthia. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. William,
thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Be well. Be the light. Thank you. I think let me just bring this up. So, everyone, I just wanted to thank William. Thank you very much for organizing this. I'll just finish by playing a video that we have. All of you, if you've listened to this and you want to support our movement, go to Shiva4president.com. Get involved. Get involved doesn't mean being on social media and having polemics with idiots. It means go get a bumper sticker. Get one of these bumper stickers, okay? Put it on your car. This is bottoms up. You can, if you're outside of the United States, get one of these bumper stickers, shatter the swarm. But it's time to fight, and fighting means get on the ground. You can all go to this site. I'm going to go right there. We've open sourced everything. Hey, Jason, can you take her, please? We got our pups here. If you go to shivaforpresident.com, I want to take all of you guys there, and you can go to this website right here, shivaforpresident.com, and we'll give you a task to do. This is a homework assignment, okay? Go to Shiva for President. There's a free download section right here. Get these cards. You can write us in, okay? We also have it in, if you know, we're on the ballot in about 15 states, but if they throw us off, be defiant. Write us in. The front of the card says, save yourself, write in Dr. Shiva. The reverse says they're killing you, shatter the swarm. And you can go look at this QR code to see the shatter the swarm video. But every one of you, go get this card. Hand it out. Don't sit on your ass. To the extent I do these videos, I'm on the ground fighting, okay? It's easy to talk. Go get these cards. That's your homework assignment. Download the card. Go to your local printer. You can spend 50, 25 bucks. Print out tens of these cards. And fight. Fighting means you, not me doing the work, but you. You have to save yourself. And remember, there's two things you need to do to save yourself. Number one, learn how to fight. That's theory and the politics. If you go to truthfreedomhealth.com, become a warrior scholar. Okay. Trey will put that up. Become a warrior scholar. A warrior scholar is I teach you the science of systems. Everything I've learned, what the elites know, you can learn how to fight. Go to truthfreedomhealth.com, contribute, become a warrior scholar, or go there and just start the free course. Get off the plantation. That's number one. The other thing is get involved in the campaign. And I'll end with playing our Shiva for President video. Thank you, everyone. Be well, be the light. But listen to this video.
Who would have ever thought I'd be running for president of the United States of America? I was born a low-caste untouchable in India's caste system, a system of aristocracy, oppression, and racism. My name is Dr. Shiva Ayyadure. I'm an MIT PhD, a Fulbright scholar, a scientist, engineer, entrepreneur, and inventor. My family and I left India to come to America on my 7th birthday. I grew up in the working-class neighborhoods of New Jersey, playing baseball, mowing lawns, painting houses, and coding software. My friends and neighbors are blacks, Italians, Irish, people of all races. As a 14-year-old, I wrote 50,000 lines of software code to create the world's first email system and was awarded the first U.S. copyright for email, recognizing me as its official inventor at a time when copyright was the only way to protect software inventions. I did that long before I ever came to MIT, revealing that big innovations can occur anytime, any place, by anybody. Growing up, I saw politicians dividing us by race and religion in both America and India to have us fighting each other while they remained safe in their gated communities and in their playgrounds of Hollywood, Martha's Vineyard, and Silicon Valley. I'm a fighter. I fought racism and exposed their imperialist wars, fought for workers and put my life on the line against global corruption. I never wanted to run for political office. All that changed when I saw working Americans as never before being duped by the establishment and the not-so-obvious establishment. Across left and right, we were being sold out and made to forget why we came to America and why America existed. Lawyers, academics, billionaires, celebrities and politicians, elites, Clintons, Kennedys, Bidens, Obamas, Bushes, black and white have hijacked America. They printed trillions for their friends. They delivered crumbling infrastructure, corruption and racism. They transferred trillions to themselves, dividing black and white, fear-mongering and fake science. Lockdowns and censorship, dirty air, food and water, pushing drugs upon us, making us sicker. We've been sold out. One set of rules for them and another for us. We deserve a warrior with a history of courage in putting everything on the line for you, who believes in you, not them, who has created a movement bottoms up for truth, freedom, health. I've exposed their lies at the right time, never waiting until it was popular. I've exposed their false gods who exist to lead you back to them. I've exposed their fake science of lockdowns and masking and provided you solutions to fight them and win and protect your immune system, saving millions. I exposed Fauci, galvanized the Fire Fauci campaign when others remained silent. When they stole our election, we sued the government and Twitter in our historic 2020 federal lawsuit, exposing in bare view the government and big tech censorship infrastructure, the unholy alliance between government and social media companies. Where was Elon and his grifters? They stood by the sidelines and did nothing. They did not use their megaphones to help us when it could have made a big difference. Now our movement grows for truth, freedom, health, independent of all of them. Every day, millions are learning the science of systems, the knowledge the elites do not want you to have, so you may learn how to think, stand up, and fight, independent of the establishment of left and right and their fake heroes. Now it's time for you to join the movement to win back America, to win back truth, win back freedom, win back your health. That's why I'm running for president of the United States. This race is about you. This race is about truth, freedom, health versus power, profit, control. We've had enough. They think we'll fall in line and vote again for their lawyers, celebrities, billionaires, and chosen ones from above. We choose our heroes from below, from the rank and file, who do what is right at the right time, not when it's convenient and popular. They can never represent us. What America needs is a movement by the working people, for the working people, who are educated, organized, decentralized, and fight for independence from their systems of control. And that movement exists. It's ready for you. We don't need them. We need us to go bottoms up, neighbor to neighbor. My journey, your journey, are all the same. It's our time. It's time we had one of us. It's time to win back truth, freedom, health, to win back America. Be part of this historic movement, all the way to our victory on November 5th, 2024. If you're an American citizen, pledge your vote now for Dr. Shiva Ayyadure, the independent candidate for U.S. president. No matter where you live, you can be a part of this. Volunteer as little as 20 minutes a day. Don't delay. This is Dr. Shiva Ayyadure, and I approve this message paid for by Dr. Shiva for President.
All right, everyone, if you came late to this, you may want to watch it again. This was a discussion called One America, One Citizen, Why Any Citizen Can Be President. We discussed a lot of things with Dr. Cynthia McKinney, and we want to thank William at Rec Streams for making this happen. But get involved. Don't sit on the sidelines. Don't just pontificate. You know, take action. As I mentioned earlier, you can go to shivaforpresident.com and download these cards, print them out, and start handing them out to people. We have 90 days to get the vote out. That's how you guys can help. You can literally do this on your own. Print out these cards and plaster them everywhere, wherever you want to put them. There's also in Spanish, salvate tu mismo por escrito, which means save yourself. You can have people write us in and where they're taking us off the ballot illegally. We show defiance. And look what's going on here. The cost of living is going up and lifespan is going down. Begin by watching this video. Tell people, save yourself, write in Dr. Shiva, let them know they're killing you, shatter the swarm, and learn how to fight back. Okay? So that's your task. Do it. Save yourself. No one is coming to save us. All right? No one is coming to save us. As long as you remember that, then you'll get off your ass and do something. Otherwise, you'll think, I'm going to do something. Fucking Trump is. Trump ain't going to do anything. He's going to keep cocksucking Zionism all day. And we know where Kamala Harris came from. She has a lot of experience doing that. All right. Be well. Be the light.